has been detained or wants to report ICE, more information is available at Shirla at 888-624-4752 for legal help and resources. It is bilingual. More information at chirla.org.
Hey, this is Michael O'Keefe. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest and China Lake. Radio powered by the people.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall. My co-host Jim Lafferty is on vacation, but he'll be back with us next week. And I'm so excited to tell you about today's show. In our first half hour, Brazil expert James N. Green will talk to us about what's going on in Brazil, from the 27-year prison sentence just handed down to its former president to how its current president, Lula da Silva, is balancing a polarized public, trade negotiations with Trump, and U.S. military aggression against its neighbors. Then, in our second half hour, I'll be joined by attorney Stevie Glaberson from the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law School. She'll talk with us about their latest report on the U.S. government's illegal collection of DNA from immigrants and U.S. citizens alike. So, without further ado, let's get started. This segment, we're turning our focus south to Brazil, a country facing many of the same struggles we're seeing in the U.S. and around the world, the fight for democracy, for the planet, and for truth in politics. On the political front, Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, is appealing a 27-year prison sentence for staging a coup. And current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, also known as Lula, once a union leader and symbol of the left, announced he's running for re-election. It's truly a test of his diplomatic skills, given polarized voters, as well as the ever-complex relationships with other countries, and especially Donald Trump. Of course, Brazil is important for many reasons. For instance, the environment. It's home to about 60% of the Amazon rainforest, which is known as the lungs of the earth. It releases so much oxygen into our atmosphere that we all rely on. In just a few weeks, Brazil will host COP30, the United Nations Climate Conference, in the Amazon city of Belém, a region under threat from deforestation, displacement, and exploitation. To help us understand all of this, we're joined by James N. Green, Emeritus Professor of Brazilian History and Culture at Brown University, where he was also the director of the Brazil Initiative. He's spent decades studying Brazil's political and social transformations, from the military dictatorship years to today's democratic challenges. And he's written extensively on human rights, LGBTQ plus activism, and Brazilian-U.S. relations. Professor James N. Green, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you so much for inviting me again to be with you.
Sure. Well, let's start with presidential politics. Former President Jair Bolsonaro is appealing his 27-year prison sentence. Remind us what led to his conviction and tell us on what grounds he's appealing. And also talk about his political clout that may or may not remain.
So he, Jair Bolsonaro was president from 2019 to 2022. And starting in 2021, he started questioning the legality of the voting system in Brazil, which is electronic voting machines, which have been proved kind of impenetrable by hackers, etc. He then did a series of activities clandestinely with sectors of the armed forces to try to carry out a coup should he lose the election. He lost the election to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. It was a tight race, 51-49%. Then he mobilized his supporters to block the highways all over the country and then eventually camp out in front of army barricades. And then after Lula was inaugurated on January 1st, 2023, a week later on Sunday, His supporters mobilized from the chief army barracks, in front of the chief army barracks in Brasilia, to the square that houses the seat of the executive branch, the Congress, and the Supreme Court, breaking into the buildings, destroying them, and trying to create a situation which would have justified the military to intervene and declare martial law and therefore a state of siege and a dictatorship. So he was convicted by the Supreme Court. And it, with his 27-year sentences, other people who were involved in the conspiracy got lesser sentences. And he's questioning now the informant, the person who was his chief aide, who turned state evidence against him, questioning the veracity of his statements, arguing that there was no concrete coup, and therefore these were just ideas or thoughts or possibilities that they were running through their mind. There's a movement in the Congress by his supporters for an amnesty, to reduce the sentence or give it up. It's very unlikely that will happen because that will go back to the Supreme Court if the Congress passes it, and the Supreme Court will very likely rule against that. So the plot thickens in that the son of Jair Bolsonaro, Eduardo Bolsonaro, who is a congressman, is a senator, went to the United States to lobby the Trump government to interfere in the judicial process to free Jair Bolsonaro and establish 50% tariffs on Brazil as part of that punishment. And so Brazil got slapped with 50% tariffs, even though it has a commercial, the United States has a commercial advantage with Brazil. Brazil imports more US goods than the US imports Brazilian goods. So there's a huge trade imbalance in favor of the United States, but nevertheless impose these sanctions. His appeal will probably, as I said, will be ineffective, and then the question will be what will his supporters do in the presidential elections that are coming up in 2026, which we'll probably talk about a little later in the program.
Yes, definitely. I want to talk about the election coming up. So let's turn now to Brazil's current president, Lula da Silva, who announced he's running for a fourth term as president. How is his popularity holding up? What are the issues he's running on? And what kinds of candidates are running against him?
So Brazil tends to be very polarized, even though there are over 28 political parties. They tend to move into two camps. And the center-right is kind of disappeared because the far right is pulled into their realm, more moderate center-right candidates and politicians. Lula will run for a fourth term. It's legal in Brazil. One can run for two terms, and if there's an intervening term of another president, can run for another two terms, and he will be running for his fourth term in office. His popularity was somewhat weak before the implementation of the tariffs, but it was such an outrageous act by the U.S. government, and even more so that the son of the former president was actually going to the United States and punishing Brazil by lobbying for the tariffs, that there was a huge surge in nationalism and popularity and anti-Americanism, keeping in mind that the United States supported the military coup of 1964, which led to 21 years of authoritarian regime. And so there's a strong anti-American sentiment. In response, Bolsonaro's supporters organized on Independence Day a huge demonstration with a big American flag in São Paulo, which really did not go over well at all. It was one of these massive flags that people were carrying like a half a block long, and it really backfired. And during the period of the Bolsonaro regime, the far right embraced the Brazilian flag and kind of appropriated it, and it was reappropriated by the left right now. Lula, I think, is going to run on a campaign of continuing to try to carry out the social reforms that he has implemented over the course of his presidencies. The economy still has some problems. There's tremendous budgetary problems and very little money in the budget for social programs. He also faces a very hostile majority right-wing Congress. So there's a lot of challenges to him. It's not clear yet who will be running against him. Originally, the governor of the state of São Paulo, which is the most important state in the country economically in terms of population and its political importance, Tarcísio de Freitas had talked about the possibility of running as a presidential candidate. But now he's saying he thinks he's going to run for the governorship of São Paulo. And if that's the case that he doesn't run, there are three other candidates. One of them is a person who has a very strange name in Portuguese, who's Ratinho Jr., which would mean Little Rat Jr. He's son of a journalist, a kind of a populist, right-wing populist journalist. He's the governor of the state to the south of São Paulo. And he has a certain amount of backing by both the right and the far right forces. He also is calling for an amnesty for Bolsonaro to buttress up that support. There's another candidate named Zema, who is in the state of Minas Gerais, which is also a very, very important and large state with a large population. But he's a very flat and unpopular person. There are other candidates. I won't go through all the details. But at this point, it's not clear who's going to run. Some people have to give up their positions as governors to run. And if they lose, then they lose their position. And so a lot of people are not calculating. Is it possible that Lula could actually win on the first round? If he doesn't get an absolute majority, there's a second round. Some of them are kind of calculating, well, maybe it doesn't make sense for me to run now. Let's wait four more years for Lula to finish his second mandate. And then let's run against the Workers' Party, the broad center-left coalition in 2030. So it's far away from the elections. They're going to be in October of 26. There'll be two rounds if there's not a clear majority in the first round. And anything can happen in this time. It's very hard to predict what will happen a year from now. Lula is ahead in the polls. His approval rate is improving. But there could be a turn in the economy. There could be some other crisis that could disrupt that possibility. The country is still very polarized.
Right. And we know anything can happen between now and then. And just to follow up on a quick item, here in the U.S., you know, most people think of it as basically a two-party system. But it's not that way in Brazil, right?
There's 28 political parties in the Congress. So some of them only have one member of the party.
I see.
But it becomes two-party in the sense that in the first round of the presidential elections, there might be five or six candidates. Some of the small parties run candidates for other reasons, just for popularity or getting their name out. But then in the second round, it always boils down to two. And now the configuration has been a broad center-left coalition and a broad center-right coalition and an extreme right. I mean, the fascist right is part of that coalition. And so whereas in Congress, there will be a big dispute about whether the right controls the Senate. And if they do, they're going to start processing procedures to probably impeach some of the Supreme Court justices who called for the or who ruled in favor of punishing Bolsonaro. There's another element here, which I forgot to mention, which is very important, that part of the package of the United States punishing Brazil was to decree that the Supreme Court justice in charge of the hearing over Bolsonaro would be violating the Magnitsky Act, which was designed to really punish gross violation, human rights violators from Russia who were involved in massive corruption. And they're using that to punish Alexandre Moraes. They've also taken away the visas, U.S. visas of seven, of I think eight of the 11 Supreme Court justices, and including the Ministry of Health, because he was involved at another moment in a program called Mais Médicos, More Doctors, which brought Cuban doctors into Brazil to service areas where Brazilian doctors weren't really interested in serving, mostly in the countryside and the far out regions. And now they're arguing that this was an illegal act, and therefore the Minister of Health, Alexandre Padilha, when he went to the United, he was scheduled to go to the United Nations in September, but was only allowed to operate in a five-block area in New York. And so he said, forget it, I'm not going to go on those conditions. So he didn't actually go to the United Nations during the opening ceremonies that happened in September. So it's a situation which is very polarized, very dynamic, and anything could happen. But at this point, the center-left is looking favorable on the outcomes for 2026.
Interesting. Wow. Well, since Trump took office in January, Brazil-U.S. relations have been rocky, especially over trade and tariffs. We've talked about that on a former show. So what's the latest, what's behind the latest disputes?
Well, I mean, again, it's Trump's irrationality, because there's no, makes no sense at all. And he keeps on repeating this fact that there's a trade deficit with Brazil, which there's just the opposite. It was really a tariff that was designed to punish Brazil because of this political question of demanding that the government of Brazil interfere in the judicial process to absolve a person who is under trial, which is, You know, it's inappropriate. It's totally a violation of Brazilian sovereignty. So in this regard, the tariff situation is now being negotiated. When Lula spoke at the opening session of the United Nations, and it's the tradition for the Brazilians to kick off the opening session speeches. And then immediately after that, Trump spoke, and the teleprompter wasn't working, and he actually ended up interacting with Lula for about a minute and a half and kind of liked him. And Lula's a very charismatic, warm character, and then got up, and when he gave his speech, he was giving a speech criticizing Brazil, and then all of a sudden he went off record and then said, I just met Lula, I really like him, I think we have a click and things are going to go well. And as a result of that, they had some interchanges, there was a telephone call, and then they both met in Malaysia. I think the Brazilian was not interested in meeting in the White House because they didn't want Trump to flip on them and abuse them as he did to Zelensky and the Prime Minister of South Africa. And it was a fairly positive meeting for negotiations to try to reduce the tariffs. The problem with Brazil in this situation is, as we see from what happened just last week in Canada, that Trump can, in a moment's notice, slap on another 10% of tariffs as he did against Canada because they published the, or they transmitted an, the province, one of the provinces of Canada transmitted an ad, which was basically a speech that Reagan gave in 87 criticizing tariffs. And that provoked that. So it could, the same thing could happen with Brazil. The problem that Trump is facing now, and I think this is one of the reasons why he might move on certain questions, is that beef prices are really going hot, skyrocketing in the United States, and he really hasn't done anything to address inflation, and his tariff policies are inflationary. So in order to blackmail the Argentinian people, Trump promised $20 billion in a bailout loan to the country of Argentina just before the congressional elections, which took place on Sunday, to support his ally, a guy named Milei, who is a kind of an anarcho-libertarian, who considers himself very much in line with Trump, and also introduced the idea of the chainsaw before Elon Musk used that. Elon Musk kind of stole the idea from Milei in Argentina. And Milei is an extreme right candidate, shrinking the government, cutting social service programs, cutting university budgets, everything. And Trump promising the $20 billion kind of tipped the election to a certain extent in Milei's favor, and he actually won a larger percentage of members of his in the Congress, which will allow him to rule more. And then Trump is also promising now that the right-wing candidate won to also increase significantly beef imports to the United States, which of course is causing havoc among cattle producers there because there's going to be competition with their goods, and that's going to be very problematic for them. And I think that because Brazil has also a huge export in beef as well, not only to the United States, but to China, especially, and to Europe, it's very likely that I think one of the things they're going to do is drop the restrictions or the trade restrictions on beef and probably coffee. And then probably Trump will demand some kind of access to the rare minerals. I don't actually know what it's called in English. I know it's just known in Portuguese, but you know, the special minerals that are very hard to get, which are needed for high-tech production and in batteries and in electronics, etc. So probably that will happen, and that Brazil will concede to a certain extent on that point. And so far, there's been no talk about any question regarding Bolsonaro. So it looks like, for the moment at least, Trump has thrown him under the bus, is less interested in him than he is in other things. But that could change overnight should Trump's mood shift some evening when he's tweeting at 2 a.m.
Mm-hmm. Right. It does show the mutual reliance on each other, though.
For example, this is another example of the stupidity of the tariffs. Brazil produces a huge amount of soybeans, and there are a lot of ecological issues related to that. But nevertheless, and a large receiver of soybeans was the United States. And now, with the tariffs that China has imposed in retaliation to the United States on soybeans, American soybean exporters cannot access the Chinese market. It's just prohibitive because of the tariffs. And now, Brazil will be shifted, almost immediately shifted their export, took just a month or two, to China. And so They're actually competing with U.S. exporters who can't really compete at this moment because of the tariffs. But if the tariffs with China are dropped, they've really consolidated a relationship between Brazil and China, or deepened that relationship, which was supposed to be just the opposite of what Trump intended to do with the tariffs. So his policy is erratic and irrational, making no sense.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall, and I'm speaking with Brazil expert James N. Green, emeritus professor at Brown University. Well, a major development in the past few weeks is the U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean. The strikes on ships have killed 57 people to date, and Trump has threatened both Venezuela and Colombia. Has Brazil's leadership weighed in on the U.S. aggression against its very close neighbors?
So this is a very complex question to answer simply, because to a certain extent, the Brazilian government distanced itself from the Venezuelan government because it came to the conclusion that the last elections were not fair, and that the government refused to show the electoral list of the results to verify whether actually the government won or didn't win the elections. But Brazil offered in this encounter in Malaysia with Trump to intervene and to be a mediator between Venezuela and the United States. Whether that happens or not, it's not clear to me. But clearly, Brazil is very concerned about the possibility of an intervention in Venezuela. And we have the example of Manuel Noriega being invaded, Panama being invaded by the Bush administration, the Grenada invasion of 1982, which no one remembers, or 83, but it was another invasion that the United States did on a Caribbean island. And so there is a possibility of that. And, you know, Trump has already announced clandestine funding from the CIA to overthrow the government. And the question will be whether it would be a strategic invasion, which would kind of lightning go in and take out the presidency and some key people. I don't think there's going to be a long-term land invasion. I don't think that's possible. And even though the government has weakened and it doesn't have as much popular support as it did in the past, the Venezuelan government, and so there is theoretically going to be popular resistance, it's not clear to me to what extent that can withhold any major onslaught by the United States. We'll have to see about that. But it's a tremendous concern, not just for Brazil, but for all of Latin America, because of the historic ways in which the United States government has interfered in practically every single country in the region over the course of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Well, switching topics now to the environment, I want to get this one in. So in just a few weeks, I think early November, early to mid-November, Brazil is hosting COP30 in Belém on the edge of the Amazon. What does hosting this major climate conference mean for Brazil? And what kinds of outcomes are anticipated? How is the government preparing? And what do the people think about all of this?
So Brazil hosted the UN conference Rio 92, which kind of kicked off the concern about the environment. And it's been a very important part of the movement since then, with a very strong environmental movement here, a very strong indigenous movement, which is a relatively recent thing, which is also making very serious claims that they're the best people to take care of the Amazonian region and other regions of the country. And so there's a lot of expectation that there will be positive outcomes of this meeting. There have been huge infrastructural problems with how hosting the conference in Belém, which is at the mouth of the Amazon River, because it's going to be an onslaught of people there, and there wasn't enough housing and preparation. And so there was a huge speculation in housing costs, and a lot of delegations claimed that they weren't going to go at some point. Some of them have turned around and said differently. So there's a frustration that it was held in a, it's going to be held in a place which didn't really have the ability to absorb all the people who wanted to participate. And so I think there is going to be massive participation of environmental groups and social movements in Brazil there. There'll be an alternative COP30 for them to articulate their concerns. The official government will be trying to issue some kind of new statements. I'm not really following the details of the negotiations, but those are usually held behind doors to see if you can get consensus among key players and then announce something and then have it approved. I'm sure Brazil wants that to happen. Lula has invited even Trump to come to COP30, although he won't go because he doesn't believe in climate change. But it will be, I think, important symbolically for Brazil to If we go beyond the infrastructural problems, which will inevitably be part of the journalistic reporting on the matter, if some good, strong resolution advancing environmental protection can come out of the meeting, that will also be a boost for Brazil as a country that mostly is dealing with the environment. It has tremendous pressures because its major exports are agribusiness and cattle, and that is destroying the savanna, which surrounds the Amazon region. There's massive deforestation in this area of the country and a massive production of soy and sugar and other goods that will ultimately destroy the environment and could affect the Amazon region because the savanna around it is the water basin that holds the waters that will be also important in the Amazon. So we'll see what happens. It's looking positive, and we'll see what are the actual results that the conference brings to the movement for improving the environment and limiting climate change.
Well, one quick follow-up I had on that, as I've been following the news, The Guardian published an article about, you know, I think the title was something like, Brazil is failing its uncontacted peoples. And I think in the United States, we don't really have a sense of what uncontacted peoples means, because we don't really have groups of people here who are uncontacted. Can you just tell us briefly what that means?
There are several hundred indigenous groups that are ethnically different with different languages. Most of them were in the process of being massacred or in a genocide that the Portuguese carried out in the colonial period. Many managed to survive by fleeing into the hinterlands and to the deep regions of the Amazon as the Portuguese and the Jesuits and others kind of went into these areas of the country and occupied it. And so there are actually small groups of indigenous peoples who have no contact with the West. And in the past, there had been a policy at the turn of the 20th century for a pacification of those indigenous people by seducing them into Western society by leaving gifts, leaving goods, and then kind of slowly bringing them in to integrate them into Brazilian society. This very strong indigenous movement that I mentioned earlier, which has really had tremendous influence in terms of the visibility and the demands that it's making, is really questioning this policy and the danger it is, because obviously these people uncontacted are extremely vulnerable to viruses and diseases and bacteria and can die very quickly because they don't have immunity to them. And the question of the guaranteeing of the rights of indigenous people to their own space and their own lands. And so there's this dispute between, on one hand, a government which, formally speaking at least, is demarcating and recognizing lands, and economic interests which are very interested in invading these lands because there's a huge amount of rare minerals and gold and rare lumber and the possibility of going in and extracting this the high-end lumber or these minerals into indigenous lands without giving any without the indigenous people giving any permission to them. And so there is, for the first time in the Luz Lula government, there is a minister of indigenous affairs. Her name is Sonia Guajajara. She's indigenous. The person who heads the indigenous agency kind of is also an indigenous woman. And so women have taken a really important role in the indigenous movement as well, and will be very visible in the COP 30 and have been trying to get their word out internationally. So it's a serious question still, and it will be continuing to be a controversial issue, I think, in the years to come because of this clash between indigenous rights, indigenous interests, and those of economic forces that are trying to go in and steal the land or steal the things within the land that are indigenous territories.
Wow. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. So, Professor Green, where can listeners learn more about Brazilian politics, about its culture, of course, about you and your writings?
Well, I am the president of the Washington Brazil Office, which is a think tank and an advocacy organization in Washington, D.C., to offer a progressive vision of Brazil. And you can reach us by going through the site WashingtonBrazilOffice.org. And we have a weekly newsletter we send out free. If you can sign up for it, you can receive just a very brief news of the week of what's going on in Brazil, highlights, an editorial, and an article about some question that we think is important. We're going to be escalating next year to defend the Brazilian elections, so there'll be a lot more activities happening next year. But join us in this effort. And it's a pleasure to be with you as always.
Great. Thank you so much, James N. Green, Emeritus Professor at Brown University, Brazilian expert. Thanks again for joining us on the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Maria.
All right. Well, that was my interview, which I did earlier this morning due to time change, with James N. Green, our resident expert on Brazil. And now we're going to pause for a very brief station ID, but please stay with us for our next segment on the U.S. government's unconstitutional collection of DNA from immigrants and U.S. citizens. Stay tuned.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake.
My audio might have had a glitch, but we are back. I'm Maria Hall, and this is the Lawyers Guild Show. My co-host Jim Lafferty is on vacation this week, but he'll be back next week. In the meantime, please stay tuned. We've got another great segment coming up about how the U.S. government is illegally collecting DNA of immigrants and U.S. citizens. Let's get started. In 2024, the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law School released a troubling report called Raiding the Genome: How the United States Government is Abusing Its Immigration Powers to Amass DNA for Future Policing. As the title suggests, the report documents a troubling expansion of the U.S. government's unconstitutional DNA collection program. Last month, the center released an update called Raiding the U.S. Citizen Genome. It describes how U.S. Customs and Border Protection has knowingly taken DNA from U.S. citizens on a regular basis and without any independent oversight. It then shares the DNA samples with the FBI, and the FBI, in turn, adds the DNA to a national crime database called CODIS. That can be searched by police all over the country. Is this ethical? Is it legal? And is there anything we, the people, can do to stop it, or at a minimum, impose more limits? To talk us through these questions and more, I'm very happy to introduce to you one of the authors of the report, Stevie Glaberson. Stevie is the Director of Research and Advocacy for the Center, and she supervises the Center's programmatic work. Stevie's primary area of legal expertise is the surveillance and policing of marginalized families. All right, well, Stevie Glaberson, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Sure. Well, let's start with the basics. Where did the Center gather its data from, and how reliable is it?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So we have been researching the government's expansion of DNA collection for a number of years. But most recently, in like the summer of 2024, we got together with a couple of partners, Amica Center for Immigrant Rights and Americans for Immigrant Justice, and we filed a Freedom of Information Act request to both CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, and ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that your listeners might be familiar with these agencies, to try to get. We had a number of questions, and I think we had like 11 questions in each of the requests, asked basically the same thing of each agency. Submitted those requests and tried to get more information about this program that way. Those requests largely went unanswered. We're actually, with our partners, suing the government right now over the rest of that request. But in February of 2025, as a result of that request, the government did make one disclosure. It was too big to send to us, but they uploaded to a website a series of massive spreadsheets showing everyone who the government had collected DNA from under this program. And it's hard to tell how many people are really represented there because for good reason, to protect people's confidentiality, they've excised like the identifying information. We don't have people's names. We don't have people's like A numbers. But there are, this was just from CBP. So we still do not have information from ICE. And this is just for the years from 2020 to 2024. But there are somewhere between 1.3 and 2.8 million people represented in those spreadsheets. And so after we got the spreadsheets, we did a bunch of work and, you know, they're publicly posted. So other media outlets did a bunch of work to analyze what was there. And we discovered a number of things. We discovered, actually, a reporter at Wired was the first to write about there being a 4-year-old in the government's data set, who, according to the government's own data, the government has taken the DNA of a 4-year-old and sent it to the FBI for addition to CODIS. There's like something like 133,000 minors in the data set. They're taking DNA from, you know, 14-year-olds and stuff like that. And most recently, we did an analysis of the U.S. citizens that are appearing in that data set as people who CBP has taken their DNA and sent it to the FBI. And we found, according to the government's own data, that there are about 2,000 U.S. citizens in there, many of which it does not appear to be lawful for the government to have taken their DNA. There don't appear to be any checks to ensure that a U.S. citizen wouldn't erroneously be swept up in this program that is itself a nightmare for, you know, we think unconstitutional, no matter the citizenship of the person who's being swept up. That's where we got our information.
Wow. Well, I'm definitely going to get into a lot of those points you made into a little more detail. So tell us, you know, you mentioned the numbers of people whose DNA was collected by Customs and Border Protection. Where were they when it happened? Do you know anything about that? Were they in detention? Were they arrested for something? You know, what were the circumstances that allowed CBP to take the DNA?
Yeah, so that's actually a really interesting and layered question. So on one level, the answer is, so CBP tends to operate at the border. So we don't know exactly where the people were when they encountered CBP, but we do know sort of the field offices from which that sent the data to the FBI. And those tended to be along the southern border, but not exclusively. So, you know, there's people who were at Chicago's Midway Airport who had their DNA sent to the FBI. There's people who were encountered at Detroit's airport. But CBP does tend to operate at the border. So those folks are people who are in some way crossing the border. But ICE is also doing this. ICE is also collecting DNA. And ICE operates in the interior. And so our understanding is anyone, anywhere who encounters a DHS agent of any type could be subject to DNA collection. The other part of your question that's really important and interesting is, like, what kind of interaction with a DHS agent could result in you having your DNA collected? And under the law, it says that that DHS can collect DNA from any non-U.S. persons that the government detains. And there's a separate provision that says that a U.S. citizen who's charged, you know, credibly accused of a crime can have their DNA collected on that basis. But there's this provision about detainees, people who the government is detaining. That is where this massive spike in DNA collection is coming from. And what it means to be detained is not the same as what it means to be criminally arrested. And that has really important constitutional implications. It's your listeners, you know, I think folks in LA are probably paying attention to this and might be very aware of this at this point. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean someone who is held for a long period of time in like a camp or a jail, although that certainly would qualify. A DHS detention can be sort of anything at any time for any length of time. And there really are no checks on DHS agents' power to detain someone the way there might be in the criminal system. The situation that folks are in when they're encountering a DHS agent is so coercive and so imbalanced. And You know, when we were doing our original research, we published a big report back in 2024 and have since published these smaller updates focused on just, you know, the most recent one is focused on U.S. citizens. But in the major 2024 report that listeners can find on our website, we reported what we heard from folks who had experienced DNA collection. And people reported sort of one of two things. They either didn't even understand that's what was happening. We have some reports that DHS agents were lying to people about what it was. Mm-hmm. People thought, you know, this started during COVID. So people thought it was a COVID test. They thought it was to check for illness. So how can you consent when you don't even know what you're consenting to? But also those who did understand, you know, there were many people who understood what was going on, but did not know or did not feel that they had the power to resist. And actually, we have some information that when Title 42 was in place, Trump's return to Mexico policy, DHS agents said that they, if someone refused to give a DNA sample, they would just be sent back to Mexico. Mm-hmm. And since that policy ended, we've heard that while they might not send someone back to Mexico on that basis, they might detain someone where that person otherwise would be released. So I don't think that consent would cure this kind of violation in this, under these circumstances.
Yeah. Was it taken with a swab or some other way?
Our understanding is that it's all with a swab. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's get into the Fourth Amendment a little bit, which is supposed to protect we the people from unreasonable searches and seizures by the government, because we, the people, give the government so much power that we also need to limit it from intruding on our privacy. Just a little commentary there. But is taking DNA something that would usually require a warrant before the government can seize it from us? And if so, if it would require a warrant otherwise, how is the government justifying, on the broader basis, how is it justifying this practice of collecting DNA?
Yeah, so the most recent court case or Supreme Court case that sort of weighed in on this question, and we talk all about this in our report, is Maryland versus King, which was about whether the state of Maryland could, without a warrant, collect DNA from individuals that the state arrested on criminal charges. Mm-hmm. So clearly, the Fourth Amendment protects against unwarranted and unreasonable searches and seizures. And if there's individual suspicion that rises to a certain level and a judge checks it and issues a warrant, that's generally considered to be a sufficient check. But in these cases where there is no warrant and this is not based on necessarily individualized suspicion that you're trying to, you know, generate evidence for a specific crime, when is it okay for the government to take this kind of collection? So that's what Maryland versus King looked at. And in that case, there are a couple of really salient features that we think are really important to think about when you think about whether it applies to DNA collection. So the Supreme Court in Maryland versus King said it was okay for Maryland to take DNA from people it criminally arrested, but there were sort of two really important caveats to that decision. One is that the court was clear many, many times that they were talking about criminal arrests on the basis of probable cause that the person had committed a serious crime. And that's important not because, like, then the person is a criminal, because there's still a whole process. That's not what this is about for us. That's important because that requirement is embodied in that is some very specific checks on the arresting officer's power. To have probable cause, it's not a ton of suspicion, but it is individualized suspicion. And in the criminal system, those decisions are either checked in advance on the warrant requirement or, you know, afterwards during a probable cause hearing. And that's so important because an individual, a judge, a magistrate, someone outside of the chain of command of the executive agency that is focused on, like, investigating and arresting people is checking whether the agency is doing it right. That's absent in immigration enforcement. When someone is detained by DHS, there is no outside entity that is looking over their shoulder and saying, yep, you did it right this time or not. And in fact, many of the people we looked into, you know, very specifically into these U.S. citizen cases in the data, many people were never even presented to not even a judge, but to their cases were never presented to an AUSA, a DOJ lawyer, to even consider whether charges were warranted or whether to like move forward with any kind of process. They were just had their, you know, stopped, had their DNA taken, and then released. So there's no one checking to see, the way there was in Maryland versus King, to see whether it's done correctly. The other piece that's really interesting about Maryland versus King is that a big part of the court's decision hinged on Maryland's rationale that it provided to the court for why it needed the DNA. And Justice Scalia wrote a sort of scathing dissent in that case. And I don't often agree with Justice Scalia on everything, but in this case, I would highly recommend that decision because, you know, he said sort of their reliance Maryland put forward this rationale that it needed the DNA to identify people in its custody, that it wasn't doing it to solve crimes, that it was doing it because it needed the DNA in order to like know that this is the person that we intended to arrest or something like that. But when you actually scratch at Maryland's rationale and the rationale that the court hinged its decision on, it's not identification by any normal understanding of that word. And so when the government came in 2020, when the government went to change the rules so that it could massively expand DNA collection at DHS, we can tell that the government really had Maryland versus King in mind, because in the rulemaking procedure where the government has to say what their rationale is, they really wrapped themselves in this identification rationale, saying, oh yeah, we only need this DNA, not for crime solving, but for identifying folks. But actually, in this case, they also added on another fifth rationale, which was crime solving. And that's, you know.
Leads to the next question, I bet.
Yeah. But it sort of taxes, I think Scalia's words were something like, it taxes the credulity of the credulous, that the idea that this is for anything other than surveillance and crime solving. It is not in any way that we understand for identifying folks.
Right, like fingerprints. We're pretty used to fingerprint being used to identify somebody. But DNA has a whole other slew of information.
That's right.
Rather than a fingerprint.
That's right.
Eek. Okay, well, that does lead me to my next question, which earlier you mentioned an acronym called CODIS, and that the report points out that many of the DNA profiles that are collected in this program end up in a federal DNA database called CODIS. What is CODIS, and what happens if my, for example, DNA ends up there?
Yeah, so CODIS is the Combined DNA Index System. It is, I think CODIS is actually the name of the software. Mm-hmm. And it is a federally run DNA database that the FBI runs for use in criminal investigations. There are a couple of other uses, like identifying missing persons and unidentified remains. But what the system is used for is for criminal investigations when there's like genetic material found as part of a criminal investigation. Police can run the sample against the known person index in CODIS to see if there's a hit. And that is where these individuals' DNA is being added. And I explained that, you know, folks who are detained by DHS, it's not for any criminal purpose, you know, even if it's an immigration violation, that's a civil violation. But regardless, they are added to something called the Offender Index in CODIS, and their DNA is kept there for use in criminal investigations on in perpetuity, as far as we can tell. Mm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about racial profiling. The report highlights that communities of color are disproportionately impacted by this program. So how are these racial and immigration status disparities playing out? And I think you mentioned earlier, the Fourth Amendment is there to protect both citizens and non-citizens, isn't it? Talk about this.
Yeah, absolutely. The Fourth Amendment applies at the border, in the interior, whether you're a citizen or not. The Fourth Amendment is supposed to protect you. We only have the data that we have, and we don't necessarily have information about people's race or how they appear. But we did have, from the spreadsheets that CBP shared with us, people's countries of citizenship that the government wrote down. And, you know, when we first, before we got the spreadsheets, when we wrote our first report, we assumed, we believed, based on all available evidence, that this would likely target certain communities because we know which communities DHS and its component entities target. And surprise, the vast majority of people who CBP took their DNA and added it to CODIS came from four countries: Mexico, Venezuela, Cuba, and Haiti. About 70% of the data set is folks who have that citizenship. And we also saw, you know, recently with the LA stops and the Noam versus Vasquez Perdomo case, we're seeing DHS stopping and targeting folks based on, you know, speaking Spanish, based on their appearance, based on the kind of job that they work or the locations where they are. So it's no surprise that the vast majority of folks who are swept up in this system, citizen or no, are going to be people of color, people from immigrant communities, from these Spanish-speaking communities.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Maria Hall, and this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm speaking this segment with Stevie Glaberson from the Center on Privacy and Technology about their report called Rating the Genome, which exposes a troubling escalation of the U.S. government's collection of DNA from both immigrant detainees and U.S. citizens. One of the central concerns in the report is noting that there's a lack of oversight, transparency, and limits for the DNA collection program. So what oversight gaps did you uncover, and which agencies are supposed to be there to provide accountability but are maybe just kind of turning their back and aren't doing so?
Yeah. So first, I mean, a major piece is this piece that I've already explained about there being no judges in the mix. There's no, for each of these cases, there's no outside entity, there's no neutral party who's reviewing whether this DNA collection was appropriate or whether this stop was appropriate. But, you know, barring that, you would hope that DHS would police itself. We're seeing with these U.S. citizen examples that DHS is transgressing the limits of its own authority, not just its own statutory authority, but how it has explained in its own policies what it understands its power to be. It's doing more than that. So another place where, you know, this process could stop if there were checks in place would be at the FBI, right? Mm-hmm. The spreadsheets that we got show all the people who CBP took their information and filled out a form to have that person's sample added to CODIS, which the FBI controls. So we sent a request to the FBI to find out, like, what happens when information comes to you and if it's insufficient. And so, you know, we asked them that question, and they responded to our FOIA request saying they were unable to identify any relevant records. So, you know, U.S. citizen data with no justification is going to the FBI, and even though it says it straight on the face of the form that the FBI receives, the FBI doesn't seem to have any process to weed out those samples when there's not adequate justification.
Well, can Congress or other policymakers do anything to stop or limit the DNA collection by immigration officials? And if so, is there something, listeners, is there a way that listeners can push their own representatives to do something? Who's in charge here, or ostensibly in charge?
Absolutely, Congress is in charge. Congress passed the law that gave DHS this power, and it can repeal that section. And we've said that many times. At this moment, I don't expect that to happen. But if your listeners are fired up about this. They should absolutely reach out to their congresspeople, because not only can we start to build the energy around stopping some of these abuses, but congresspeople also have a lot of power to investigate.
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of summing up, we still have a couple of minutes, but I wonder if you can just sum up for us, what are the risks to our privacy, our civil liberties, and the whole community's trust when the government and maybe even members of the public start normalizing taking DNA from people without that individual reason, probable cause, or other arrest?
Yeah, I think there's a number of layers to this. So first, for the people who are actually directly swept up in this program, they are now at risk that the government has their DNA and, you know, has their genetic, not just the profile that's added to CODIS, but has their cells, holding them in a refrigerator in Northern Virginia, as one judge said in a decision. But DNA, you know, you mentioned fingerprints. DNA is not fingerprints. DNA, the FBI likes to talk about how the sample that it puts into CODIS is sort of like all it can do is identify you and not tell anything about, more about you. But DNA is one of the most incredibly sensitive pieces of information we have. Your genetic sample includes information about your predisposition to disease, mm-hmm. your genetic ancestry, but it also not only tells information about you, but your genetic relatives, the people that you are related to. So, you know, one person's DNA held by the government implicates everyone who they are related to. But the problem is wider than even that, because on the one hand, if we start to normalize this, if what the government here is doing is constitutional, is, you know, we have a court eventually saying that this is okay under the Fourth Amendment. I mean, what does that mean for our liberties going forward?
Absolutely. Well, finally, we are out of time, but I would love for you to let listeners know once again, you know, how they can protect themselves and at the bare minimum, find out more about this program, about your organization, and where can they read the report, Raiding the Genome?
Yeah. So we are the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. I think if you Google just privacy Georgetown Law, you'll find us. All of our reports are up there. This one, the one about U.S. citizens, the one we did an update last summer, and the major report from last year. If you are someone who has been swept up in this and feel that you've had your DNA taken by DHS unlawfully, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at privacy@georgetown.edu. We are engaged in thinking about what kind of recourse you might have, so we would love to hear from you.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Stevie Glaberson of Center on Privacy and Technology. Thank you so much for being with us here today on the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks so much to our guests, Brazil expert Professor James N. Green and attorney Stevie Glaberson from the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law School. Thanks always also to our great KPFK staff like D'Angelo Jones, and Jim Lafferty, and I will be back next week on the Lawyers Guild Show. Stand up for your rights.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. Is that all that glitter is gold?
You know, maybe $75 is the right amount for you to give to KPFK. That $75 comes out to exactly 21 cents a day, and that pays for a lot of programming on KPFK. Hours of intelligent news every day on Democracy Now! And local news, local politics and culture from Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Entertaining, thoughtful shows like The Global Village, The Car Show, and Pacifica Performance Showcase. Your support makes them all possible, which is why KPFK needs your contribution right now. Tom Hartman here, reminding you that your contribution of $75 helps pay for programs that make KPFK a unique and essential part of life in Southern California. Give online at kpfk.org or call right now 818-985-2711. 818-985-2711. Thank you.
Cut to the Chase has a new time and day. Join me, Sylvester Rivers, every Friday at 8 a.m. as we share political realism.
Every candidate for Congress.
No fluff up in here.
They were given a pledge to sign.
Let's cut to the chase.
The pro-Israel lobby. You sign the pledge. If you don't sign the pledge, you don't get money.
Breaking down the lies.
4,000.